This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And we have Tommaso Vincenzo Giuseppe Bonvissuto. I was just thinking my name would be Andreas Vincenzo Giraldo Tignanelli.
That's pretty good. That's good.
Only pretty good?
Yeah. I'm not sure what the Italian Andrew is. I'm trying to think what that
Andreas.
Is. That sounds more Greek.
Well, it works for me. Come on. Work with me here, Tom.
Okay. All right.
How are you tonight?
I'm doing great.
So who's our guest tonight?
Yeah, we have a guest tonight. So Brendan Moynihan is the Managing Director of Market and Media Research at Market Field Asset Management. Where his understanding of markets and the media helps shape the firm's macro views and allocations. He's also involved at Bloomberg News as a senior advisor to the editor-in-chief. He's also working at Vanderbilt University, and he does some adjunct professor work there. And he spent 20 years on Wall Street as a trader and risk manager.
We won't hold that against him.
Yeah, that's right. And now he's writing a lot of books, and so... tonight we're going to talk to him a little about his next book on the science of risk management, but he's also written some other books about the financial panics, the financial origami as it's called, and one that's an interesting name, What I Learned Losing $1 Million. So that's intriguing.
That was a much older book though, right?
Yeah, it was, but re-released a couple of years ago.
Okay, so the book he's coming out with called Fooled by Similarity, and one of the starting chapters on that book, Brian, is you talk about the twin gods or deities, whatever you call it, Justice and Fortuna. Fortuna.
Yeah, Brendan, what do you think of that?
Well, in the pantheon of Greek and Roman deities, there are only two goddesses who are routinely presented with blindfolds on. And one is Justice and one is Fortuna. And as an opening salvo for the book, the idea is don't be fooled by the similarity of their countenances because they're blindfolded for completely different reasons. Justice is blindfolded because it is an attempt to try to find out something that happened in the past. In a courtroom, the jury is always trying to figure out what the facts are of the case. And so Justice is presented with a blindfold to be impartial to the presentation of evidence. And she has a scale of justice that she weighs the evidence that is brought in, and she has a sword to mete out justice when needed. Fortuna is presented blindfolded because she is impartial to whomever she gives good luck or bad luck in the future. And that is the launch point for a book that will talk about how people are fooled by the similarity of probability and statistics, probability being forward-looking and statistics being backward-looking.
So, Brendan, would this be sort of like the concept that, history doesn't repeat, it merely rhymes? So don't just immediately say, I've seen that before, so therefore this is going to happen. There may be a clue there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you know what's going to happen.
It does in a sense, and that's a Mark Twain quote, cleverly phrased, that history often repeats, or often rhymes, but it never repeats. The idea is that over 3,000 years, when people have faced risks that are just attendant with living, that there has always been a numerator and a denominator, and the mere fact those two exist does not mean that you can equate probability, which will tell you exactly what's going to happen going forward if you repeat the episode many times, and statistics, which just says, well, in the past, this is how many times it's happened. The problem on Wall Street is that they have confused the two. They've taken statistics and tried to convert it into probability.
Yeah, you know, and Warren Buffett has talked about this himself. He said that, you know, a lot of people are creating, you know, deciding on the concept of risk based on past performance of the past, and he said that's a fool's game. Would you agree with that?
No, I hadn't heard of it. Two, I agree. I guess one of the things I'd liken it to is, I don't follow sports closely, but I don't understand why a baseball batter has one batting average. He faces a number of pitchers. He ought to have a batting average for each pitcher. He ought to have a daytime batting average. He ought to have a nighttime batting average. He ought to have a daytime and a nighttime, whether he's at home or away. It's silly to say that those are identical cases every time he gets up to bat, because they're not, which is statistics. But in probability, you don't need to do any experiments in probability. The math will tell you what the outcome is if you do it over a large number of trials.
So as we head into the end of this first quarter of our show, why don't you give us a hook as to something that people do often with this similarities, don't be fooled by similarities, that in the real investment world that will encourage us to say, you know, hey, I got to figure out what he's saying so I don't do this.
Well, the word probability used to be a legal term. It was not a mathematical term at all. It was a qualitative assessment of evidence. It had nothing to do with a numerical quantification of things, and that's what it has become. It's the only word in the English language that has both qualitative and quantitative terms at the same time.
So, Thomas, I want you to try to say your word for him.
Brendan, my wife and I were reviewing the materials that you sent, and you know, you've done a great study of history. I got to later on in the materials, and you saw all of the different folks from antiquity that you've gotten involved in reading and reviewing. And so, as we were looking at one of the books about probability, interestingly enough, where you say that, you know, it's really where it became a branch of mathematics in 1933 with the publication of A.N. and I'm going to butcher all of this.
I will too.
A.N. Kolmogorov's. Yeah.
Kolmogorov, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Grunderif der Wagenstuckenslickenstuckenskundergenung.
That was very good, Tom.
It took that long for the subject to actually become, you know, a defined population of academic study, believe it or not.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I know you've reviewed a lot of the mathematicians and kind of how it evolved, and it'll be interesting to understand, you know, how it still evolves, because, you know, the best investors historically have been those who have studied history.
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So.
Well, Brendan, you got to hold on right now because we have to go to a pause. We're going to go to Nick Rehak and traffic and find out what's going on out there. It wasn't too great, but it wasn't horrible.
Yeah.
But we'll find out from Nick now. Nick, what's happening out there in traffic? We'll be right back.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Trees swaying in the summer.
I'm not sure, Anita. Anita thinks she's trying.
She is.
Anyway.
No summer breeze yet. Maybe later this week. We'll see.
Yeah. I hear we're going to get snow on Saturday. I'm excited. Anyway, we're here with Brendan Moynihan. We're talking about his upcoming book, Fooled by Similarity. And when I read this, the information that you sent to us, Brendan, the way I interpret it is that a lot of people use the word risk in the financial markets, and you hear the word risk thrown around a lot, but everybody's using the word in lots of different ways. It's kind of one of the things I believe you're communicating in this. Am I getting that right?
No, I think so, yes. I mean, we love the idea that we can, quote-unquote, quantify something. It's It gives us something robust to hang on to. And I think that, you know, one of the the flaws in the financial services industry is that we think that if we can measure something, it must be useful. So I would proffer this. I'll do a little pop quiz on the call right now, since there are two of you and one of me.
Okay.
If I offer you an asset using the last 86 years worth of data that gives you a 10% return on average and a 19% standard deviation, which is the generally accepted measure of risk, okay? And by the way, that's the S&P 500. 10% return, 19% standard deviation.
So in other words, it can move 19% in either direction.
68% of the time, it is up or down plus or minus 19%
mm-hmm.
in that time interval.
Okay. From the 10% median there. Yeah.
Well, 10, right, and 10% is the return, and then you have the variability of 19%, 68% of the time.
Right.
This is risk and return as defined in the financial services industry. And if at the same time I give you that alternative and I offer you a different alternative that says I can give you one that gives you 11% return and 24% volatility. So 10 and 19 or 11 and 24, which do you prefer? There's not a right or wrong answer. It's a preference. Which do you...
Well, we've read your material, Brendan. We think it's the same thing.
It is the same thing. Depending on whether you measure the S&P
same investment, yeah.
From December to December or June to June. So I don't know what is so magical about December 31st, other than people getting ready to go out for, you know, New Year's Eve parties. But for some reason, people think that investors approach the markets Rip Van Winkle style, where they put the money in there and they never look at it for, you know, 20 years. And it's nonsense. People are sold on the idea of 10 and 19, but they actually experience something tremendously different. And as I put it in the material that I sent to you, if you look at the intra-year volatility, mm-hmm. it's actually mm-hmm. 31%. So sure. People think that it's a 19% variability. Viscerally, in their gut, in their monthly or daily or weekly portfolio statements, they're experiencing more along the lines of 31% volatility. Nothing like the 19, which sounds so very subdued.
Yeah, it's you know, it's endpoint bias is part of that. It's just it's trying to, you know, it's a lot easier to quote unquote sell somebody a standard deviation of 19 instead of 31.
Yep.
You know, if you're trying to get people into the equity markets, I remember we had a local manager in town. It outperformed the S&P 500 15 years in a row if you looked on a calendar basis, and he was the first one to tell you if you changed it from, you know, January, December to February to, you know, the end of January, all of a sudden he didn't outperform because of that. So we do get caught up in that. And
well, that's great. Well, and I'll give you another one. I mean, if you need brain surgery and you go into the doctor and he says, you know, it's 66% successful. All right. So 66% of the time the S&P has closed up on the year. And by the way, it's not an S&P 500 for 86 years. The S&P 500 was created on March 4th, 1957.
Right.
5 years after Harry Markowitz wrote the seminal paper on portfolio selection. Before that, it was a 90 stock index. So, you know, we're being liberal in giving it 86 years. If I told you something was two thirds successful and we had 86 operations, would you do it? Everybody buys into it, but without even thinking about the data that's underlying it.
So in you're an investor, you're a professor in what is your degree? What is your background? Economics or
mm-hmm.
I have an undergraduate degree in corporate finance and investment management.
Okay. So how would you, as the person who has been in the investment world and you're a professor in the investment world and so forth, how would you define the word risk from an investor's point of view?
I think it is the permanent impairment of capital. I do not believe that simply because you can attach a number to the variability of returns over a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis, that gives it anything of special credibility. It makes people feel better. I think that is a quantitative notion. I think that real risk is the permanent impairment of capital. And, you know, it comes from something as simple as this exercise. You know, you could do this exercise with your listeners. You have two choices. Would you prefer a 100% chance of making $3,000 or an 80% chance of making $4,000 and a 20% chance of making nothing? That's alternative one. Then you ask the audience, would you prefer a 100% chance of a $3,000 loss or an 80% chance of a $4,000 loss and a 20% chance of nothing? Most people will take the 100% gain, even though the 80% chance of 4,000 is a greater expected return.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And most people will take the risk on the downside. They will not take the $3,000 loss. Mm-hmm. They will take the 80% chance of just get me back to even, even though that is a greater probability of loss. And that is, this is one of the, you know, I didn't make this up. This is common in diversity, but this is one of the things that people do, and they make the wrong decision at the wrong time. And I think that they bring risk upon themselves when they permanently impair their capital in those situations.
Well, we like to, in our company, we like to define risk as it's the price you pay and knowing what you're getting for the price that you're paying. That's the way we define risk.
Well, you don't know what you're getting, especially if you're thinking about the upside. And I define risk as you whacking yourself in the downside.
Well, I understand, but, you know, it's the concept, in our opinion, is that the more you understand what you're getting and the price you're paying for it, the better off you are going to be in not impairing your capital. So how would you define it in more, you know, like if you were just the average investor and you're explaining it to the average person, what kind of words would you put to it?
Well, I think that for most people, they buy into the long-term numerical presentation of what Wall Street has to offer. But when they experience in real time what Wall Street can actually serve up, they fret and they pull the trigger.
Right.
We are pattern recognizers. It's what we do. It's how we learn. It's how we process information. And when they see a series of weeks or months where correlations are moving toward one, even though over 60 years those assets are not correlated, those people pull the trigger. They flip out.
Right. So with that said, and we're coming to the end of the second quarter, let me ask you this question, and maybe we can follow up on it after we come back. With everything that's going on in the markets and the central bank running this, what I consider insane policy of 0% interest rates, and it's driven every mom and pop into the stock market and the bond market, et cetera, and don't understand what they're actually investing in, but it's doing better than sitting in the bank account, would you say that there is an unusual risk of that type of mom and dad saying, I got to get out of here?
Unusual risk of them saying they have to get out? I mean,
The market starts to tremble sometime in the future. We're going to have another bear market someday, but when we do, it might be even more interesting than before because there's tons and tons more people who have never experienced the market and are going to probably do what you're talking about.
Well, every cycle is different, and this one is going to proffer some very interesting nuances because of the types of vehicles that have been created since the last cycle. So,
when you say new vehicles?
Fixed income ETFs, which proffer supposed daily liquidity, even though the underlying asset has no inherent liquidity in it whatsoever. It trades by appointment.
Huh. All right. So, in essence, your answer was yes.
Yeah. Each cycle is different, but the short answer is yes.
All right. Hold on for us, Brendan. We're going to take a pause, and we're going to come right back. We're going to go to Nick Rehak and find out what's happening with traffic. Take it away, Nick.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I think she's pulling her leg now.
She really is.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites there, Anita.
We got to get that disco ball in here, you know.
You know, you should have a song out there about similarity and probability.
Yeah, come on. There's got to be one.
There's got to be one out there. You got 15 minutes to find one, Anita, or else. Or else. Anyway, Brendan Moynihan's here with us. We're talking about his book, Fooled by Similarity, and he's talking about people who are buying into the Wall Street story about saying, well, look here over the past history, the market's done this and that, and therefore, and you know, and so forth, and that's why you should throw all your money in the stock market, because you're going to make all this money, because that's what probabilities say, and he's saying that's ridiculous. And so, Brendan, one of the things you mentioned earlier is that risk to you is the permanent impairment of capital, and that's the important issue. But then I guess the important question that the listener would be asking is, well, what do you do to minimize the permanent impairment of capital?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the problem that we bring to the table, which is the gray cells between our ears and the emotion that accompanies that in the process. Is where we make our mistakes. It's been said that the two biggest driving emotions on Wall Street are greed and fear.
That is true.
Right. Well, it's been said that. I disagree with it. I think it's false. I think that if you are greedy means you just want more of something. So if you're long a stock and it's going up, and it stops going up and starts going down, if you were greedy, you would get out and you would get short so you could make more money. The problem is you don't know that it's getting ready to make that turn. So the problem that we face with the uncertainty of the future is two emotional responses. It's not greed and fear. It's hope and fear.
Okay.
And we experience both of them simultaneously in different amounts, and whichever one overrules dictates our action. So, for example, if you're long a stock and it's going up, you hope it will keep going up and you fear it won't. Whichever one is greater dictates. Let's say your fear exceeds. You get out. Immediately, you start hoping it will keep going down. Because you don't want it to go back up because you got out. But you're afraid it might go back up, so you don't know. And you can do this for any combination and permutation. If you're not long the stock and it's going up, you hope it will pull back a little bit so you can get in, but you're afraid it won't. So which one overrules dictates whether you get in. Fear and greed drive us. And in our investment decisions, at the earlier, you know, said earlier in the program, at the intra-year 31% volatility we all actually experience in the market, at the tops where we buy more or lever up and buy more, or at the bottoms where we puke and, you know, get out of it, this is where we impose the permanent impairment of capital on our portfolio. So it is really a risk that we'll not quantify. It's, you know, we love to be able to put things to numbers, and it makes us think that it's really, you know, concrete and substantial. The emotional aspect that we bring to the market in this, and our lack of acknowledgement of that, is really where we impair the capital.
So then we get them back to, you know, you can't just invest without understanding what you're doing and understanding what you're trying to accomplish. So what is the investment alternative to the hope and fear fallacy?
Well, I mean, I don't think that we can really remove that from the equation. The fact that we do it and we bring it to the table, whether we like it or not, all I'm trying to do is point it out so people are aware of it and acknowledge it.
But the great traders normally, the reason they are is that, or are great investors, the reason they normally are is because they have a very straightforward philosophy and system that they use, and they just follow that. If you've ever read the stories of Paul Tudor Jones and how he invested, he had a very specific system, and he followed that system without fail during his term. And Warren Buffett has done the same thing.
Right. And all I would say is that it's probably a contradiction in terms to say that Paul Tudor Jones, quote unquote, invested. Paul is a trader.
Absolutely.
And he's a trader. He's not an investor. Warren Buffett's an investor. Investing is parting with your capital with the expectation of return in the form of interest, dividends, or rent. And those come with a periodic basis. That's straight from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. That is a long time frame horizon. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you go back through, the very interesting thing is this. If you go back through where Paul Tudor Jones is most quoted, it's out of a book probably published 1987, Jack Swagger, Market Wizards.
Yep.
If you go through that book, you will find pure contradictions between the investors against investors and traders against investors about how to make money.
You're absolutely right there.
John Templeton says, diversify your investments. And Warren Buffett says, concentrate your investments. If you have a harem of 40 women, you don't get to know any of them very well. Right? Right? If you take Marty Schwartz,
right,
and you take Jim Rogers, who started Quantum Solace Fund with George Soros,
right,
he says, I've never met a rich technician. And Marty Schwartz, who won the U.S. Trading Championship 9 times, said, I always laugh at people who say I've never met a rich technician. That's a direct shot right back at Jim Rogers in the mouth. None of those people in that book agree on how to make money. Not a single one of them. They contradict each other.
But they all had a theory.
No. Where they all agree is on losing money. They agree on managing the downside. They agree on this is what... When one person's system is working, another one's is not, and the other person recognizes that. Warren Buffett has 2 rules of investing. Number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. Now, if you're trying to get rich by watching what rich people do and following them, you're never going to do it. The real thing is, what do these people say about protecting the downside? And that is a much more important lesson to learn from what those people bring to the table.
Now, this is an interesting point that you're making, because what Wall Street teaches young people, and I hear it quoted to me all the time, is that the markets go down and you just hold forever because over the long term you're going to make money and that's all there is to it. It's that simple. And what you just said is, you know, maybe that's not absolutely what you should be doing.
All I'm saying is if you do read the professional advice from the people that we all put on a pedestal to say they are successful, they are expert at managing the downside.
So how would Brendan manage the downside? What's your strategy in managing the downside?
Well, I'm a trader by profession. And
you can say it. We're not going to hold it against you.
Right? I'm perfectly ready, willing, and able to pull the trigger and get out on something that's not working. I'm not interested in the Rip Van Winkle if I hold on. I mean, look, you brought up Paul Tudor Jones. His uncle was a guy named Billy Donovan, who was a cotton trader in Memphis. And Paul Jones was so cantankerous that his uncle got tired of working with him and sent him literally down the Mississippi River to a guy named Eli Tullis. And Eli Tullis had a famous saying. He said, every trade's a winner if you have enough margin. So, yeah, if you hold on long enough, sure, everything will come back. The question is, all right, can you hold on long enough? Are you old enough to hold on long enough? And for how long is that dead capital? I think the most difficult part of, you know, what happens in the investment process is what we bring to it, you know, between our ears, which we cannot quantify. We can crunch any number in the world we want and say, okay, this is risk, this is risk. it does. There's no way we can capture the stupidity that all of us can bring to the table in dealing with our money.
You got to hold on for me, Brendan, on that line. We're going to have to hold on. We're going to go to our last pause before we finish our last quarter of the show, and we'll try to wrap it up with some ideas for the future. Mm-hmm. And right now we're going to Mark Thibodeau and weather. Take it away, Mark.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I don't know what she was trying to tell us there, Tom.
I'm not sure. It was like somebody got real excited and then they kind of went down.
Either that or she's telling us we're boring.
I don't know.
I think that's what she was trying
know.
To tell us.
I don't know. Well, we know that Brendan's not, and he's written a lot of books. He's read a lot of stuff. And Brendan, you know, when do you expect this next book to hit the streets?
Fall this year, hopefully.
Okay. Well, so let me give you an opportunity. What would be the way for people to kind of follow you, keep track of you? Do you have a blog, a website? You know, what's the best way for people to keep in touch and see what you're up
really.
To?
I mean, I'm in an industry that's sort of heavily regulated.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no blog and there's no sort of open platform, you know, that way. I would say that, I mean, the book is apt to be under contract with Columbia University Press, and so that would be an easy way to sort of, you know, monitor its progression.
Right. Yeah, and if they go on Amazon, obviously, you know, your prior books are out there. So what they could do, they could start reading some of your prior books to kind of get ready for this next one that's coming out. So that's good. Yep.
So, Brendan, I always say to people, you know, if you're going to be an investor in the market and you're going to go with this passive investment theory, how do you handle the question that can the markets go to zero? What would you answer to that? Can the markets go to zero?
No.
You're sure?
Yeah.
You're absolutely positive?
Yeah.
How can you say that markets have gone to zero around the world?
Well, because all the when you say no, I mean not financial, but so you say markets. I'm going with securities. The idea that a security, all it's doing is representing a fractional ownership in the underlying assets and earnings capacity of the firm. You know, to the extent that a firm has any sort of assets, which it must. I mean, very few have none. Then it doesn't go to zero, right? I mean,
well, it can. It has happened around the world.
What single equity market has gone to zero?
When they've been nationalized.
It doesn't. So they nationalize the securities market and the price goes to zero. The index goes to zero.
Everybody lost all their money, didn't they?
I'm sorry.
When a market got nationalized, everyone lost all their money, didn't they?
You have to show me the example.
Oh, I mean, it happened in Russia. It happened in China. It happened in Mexico. It happened
What years are you talking about?
I'll have to go back and find out the exact specific years, but the Mexican market was nationalized back in the 1930s or 40s or some 20s, 30s, and the Russian market after the Russian Revolution was nationalized, and...
I think this is a show-me-the-data phenomenon. So.
Well, okay, we'll have to get that. But have markets not been nationalized before? Haven't governments come in and nationalized markets and taken them over and taken them away from investors?
Well, okay, then maybe I should have pre-qualified the answer to you in the beginning. You said, can markets go to zero? I mean, that's very broad. Like,
but that is, you lost all your money.
Okay, so, all right, fine. Narrow it down. What country are you talking about? I mean...
So what you're saying is that it can't happen in the United States.
Well, the rule of law here is such that, right, and the property rights are so protected here as opposed to, you've got to show me the data on yours. The broad assertion is not going to be enough for me. No, the property rights here are such that every firm is going to have at least some assets. Can the stock go to one? Can the stock go to 10 cents? Sure, it can. But... unless you are investing in a single security, unless you're investing in Enron and working for Enron, I mean, which probably wasn't the smartest thing to do for any particular individual, the likelihood of the securities markets, because all the shares are doing is representing a fractional share of ownership in the assets and earning powers of the company. So.
Okay. But government is a substantial risk to markets, and we have to always remember that.
I beg your pardon?
I say governments are always a substantial risk to markets and what
they
do.
They are.
We had that in the 2008 when the government all of a sudden came in and said, well, we're just going to take over AIG and we're going to take over General Motors and we're, you know, and England said, we're going to take over this and we're going to take over that. And investors were wiped out.
They present a substantial risk, less so here than elsewhere. And I'm not taking umbrage at all with the idea that the government came in and took over the largest they took over 79.9% of the largest insurance company in the world in AIG on September 19th, 2008. And they preempted, they basically forced GM to go through a prepackaged bankruptcy, violating sort of the sanctity of bondholders in that regard. But stocks didn't go to zero. Bondholders didn't go to zero. I mean, are they a substantial risk? Sure they are. But, I mean, we've sort of turned it over to them to do that, right? I mean, we have basically relinquished the right to initiate force and given them the power of the gun to do what they want. And the power of the gun was largely behind a lot of what went on in 2008 in that regard. And they took over Fannie and Freddie, let's not forget.
That is true. That is true. So one of the interesting things you say in the end of this is you say the market went down 11.5% in 5 days. You say that the probability of that happening is 1 in 50 billion, but yet it happened.
Yeah, well, it is if you accept the premise of equity returns following a normal bell curve distribution, that's what the odds are. And I use that example is a way to show maybe we ought not be assuming that equity returns follow a normal bell curve distribution. And as you pointed out, that's only one example. I put like three or four of them in there, right?
Right.
What I haven't done is calculated what is the probability of all four of those things happening.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. I mean, I was kind of liberal, okay? So if you go back, I mean, the number of times the phrase 25 standard deviation appeared in 2008 is just ridiculous. People on Wall Street saying, oh, this is a 25 standard deviation event. There's no such, it's a meaningless number. And yet they bandied it about as though it could explain away what was happening on Wall Street. Well, look, probability distributions in games of chance do follow a bell curve distribution. Equity returns do not. And yet, the entire industry and pricing mechanism and models applied on Wall Street are predicated on that assumption. Yeah. And it's asinine.
And that's what we're going to have to end on, because we're right out of time right there. And that was the perfect quote of what this was all about, is that we have to understand that probability is not what markets are all about, but that's what they keep teaching us. Mm-hmm. And that is a big problem.
Sure
anyway,
is.
Brendan, we really appreciate you being with us. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.